Hello, and welcome back to the Normalize You podcast. I'm your host, Gabby, and I'm very stoked to get into this very first episode with our first official interviewee. Our first interviewee is a medical doctor that obtained his degree from McGovern Medical School at the University of Texas at Houston. He has specialized in the assessment and treatment of eating disorders for over 30 years. He's a member of multiple professional organizations, and he's even developed legislation in the state of Texas to mandate insurance coverage for eating disorders. He has a private practice here in Houston, Texas, as well as Austin, Texas, specializing in treating those that struggle with eating disorders. It's called Medical Center for Eating Disorders. And he is a very special person. He is actually the person that saved my life and helped me recover from a 10-year eating disorder. He is, honestly, there's not enough words in the whole world to describe how much this professional means to me, because he took the time to sit me down and help me learn how important it was that I take a break from my life to choose recovery. And so I'm very thankful for him and all of the help that he's provided me along the way. And so I thought it would be great to have him as our first interviewee. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you Dr. Edward Tyson. Hi, Dr. Tyson. Welcome to the Normalize You podcast. Thank you so much for being here today.
Hi, Gabby. Thank you for having me. I'm interested in doing this.
Yeah, I'm excited to get into the conversation. So I have some questions for you that I think have been brewing in my mind. And I think other people that follow along with me on Blogs by Gabby and just the Normalize You movement as a whole have also been pondering about. So I first kind of wanted to get started with, what made you want to get into the field of eating disorders?
It was something that snuck up on me. I did a fellowship in adolescent medicine after my family practice residency, and we had an eating disorder clinic, and it was the job of the fellow, that was me, that was I, and my job was to interview and assess any new referrals to the clinic. And then if anybody was to be admitted, I ran the inpatient team. So I had known one person personally who had severe eating disorder, a very close friend, and we had spent a lot of time during those years talking, and I had actually started my own therapy back then, so I was very curious about some of the psychodynamics, which we would talk about. But then I was also involved in the medical care as a fellow, and we had a psychologist there, and I spent a lot of time with him. I still remember the very first patient that we admitted. I think I can remember all of the patients. So they had a profound effect. I realized these people I got to work with were a very special group of people. Adolescent medicine is still the only field in medicine that mandates training in eating disorders. And I was lucky to have had that. So from that, I was not scared of people with eating disorders. I wasn't going to reject them, and started a private practice in Austin in young adult medicine. And because I was willing to see people with eating disorders, they would come. And I did, and I liked them even more, enjoyed the experience. It was challenging, exciting, worked with incredible people. And I had some therapists in town I worked with and so on. Then I left that to go back up where I trained at Oklahoma Children's Hospital. And I was director of the adolescent clinic at that time. And I saw all the eating disorders in the health sciences center. Nobody would even make an appointment for someone with an eating disorder back then. And so I got them all from all over the state. And that really pushed me to learn a lot and have to do a lot, because I had very little support. I had a dietitian, and that was it. So for the people who had to be admitted, guess who did the therapy? It was I.
Yeah.
But I had my own therapist, who's a really good psychologist and psychoanalyst, and he did supervision for me on these.
Wow.
Patients, and it worked out really well. I learned a lot. My patients were did actually very well. I was very pleased with the outcomes. And then I decided I wanted to get back to Austin, in Texas especially, and opened a private practice there just in eating disorders.
Yeah.
And we opened the satellite in Houston. So it's kind of grown. I just liked it more and more.
That's awesome. That's a really cool experience that you had. You mentioned a couple times that there was a lot of people that were unwilling to see people with eating disorders. Why do you think there is that fear for medical professionals to assist and help individuals with eating disorders?
I'll take it two different directions. One is that they don't get trained in it. Mm-hmm. That's one. Mm-hmm. The training they get is rudimentary at best. It's really to the level of, oh, well, you haven't lost that much weight, so you really aren't, don't have an eating disorder. Mm. Or you don't throw up that much, so you really don't have bulimia or something like that.
Yeah.
And another thing along those lines is people who are trained in medicine think, well, I can't handle the psychiatry part, so I have to send it to them. Mm-hmm. And the people in the psychological aspects, well, I can't handle the medical, so I need to refer it to them. So people with eating disorders are caught in this medical no man's land where you literally, like at the Austin State Hospital, they will not accept anybody with an eating disorder because they said, well, we send them to the hospital emergency room. They said, well, we can't handle this. We have to send them back to you. Then they're too medically ill for us to figure, so we send them back. And they literally will bounce back and forth.
Yeah.
So that's one part. The other one is that I think because eating disorders are so complex, they involve every organ system in the body as well as the mind. And if you're not comfortable with people like your patients telling you where you're wrong and proving it and getting used to the idea that these are really complex, you make a lot of mistakes and so on, it's pretty hard to do that. And also you have to have, I think, probably an intent to have a long-term relationship with whoever it is that comes your way.
Yeah, definitely.
And it opens up physicians to a vulnerability they don't usually like.
Hmm.
So many are trained that, you know, a chance to cut is the chance to cure, as they said in surgery, or you know, treat them and street them, that kind of stuff. Or I only have 12 minutes or 6 minutes for this visit. I can't really get into that. And it forces them into really uncomfortable things, and they rather just put their head in the sand, sadly.
Makes sense. I know I've been, go ahead.
I may add one more thing.
Yeah.
Well, short is I consider people with eating disorders to be the modern day lepers in medicine.
Mm. So what do you mean by that?
People lepers to the colonies that off somewhere where they didn't have to deal with them. Just all the lepers went to a colony somewhere. That's kind of how many of them like, well, just send them over to this hospital or get them over there.
Yeah.
It's sad.
It is. Well, I feel like the common response, and you know this as I've shared my story with you and I've shared it a lot with my audience, like I feel like the seed was planted in my head and throughout my journey with my eating disorder when my pediatrician at the time when I was 8 years old told me that I was borderline obese and I need to be put on a diet. And so I'm curious as to what your thoughts on that, because I've met so many individuals in this field and, that I've interacted with that have said, oh yeah, the first time I thought there was something wrong with my body was when my pediatrician or my general medicine doctor told me you need to go on a diet. You're gaining too much weight. Like you're overweight.
There is so much fear of the obesity epidemic that we've got to stop it. Early on, if you see some kids starting to approach upper limits of 50th percentile or above BMI, something must be wrong and you've got to stop it now. Almost like you think coronavirus is bad, wait till the obesity epidemic hits.
Oh, man.
really, to the point of ignoring obvious stuff like muscle mass.
Mm-hmm.
Or growth or whatever is going on in somebody. And just looking at a number and not putting it in context. Mm-hmm. And the usual mantra is that, well, okay, you're overweight, you're fat, or your BMI is too high, however it's put to the person who is being assessed. What's the mantra? You need to exercise and eat healthy. Mm-hmm. So then you take somebody who's inclined to get an eating disorder. Oh, I can exercise. I'll do it just like I do my schoolwork or anything else I'm involved in, where I make the best grade possible. So I'm going to exercise like it's going out of style. Mm-hmm. Like I'm training for the Olympics, and eat. I'll show you how I can eat. And then it drops. Then you've created something much worse than they had imagined was going to happen. And then the person proceeds in down this rapid and quite often rapid slippery slope. Mm-hmm. So you might say these, I'll say clinicians have the best of intentions, but you know what they say about the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Now in adolescent medicine, we do not recommend a calorie restricting diet for adolescents, mm-hmm. irrespective of BMI and all that, unless it's by somebody who really knows how to manage stuff like that, which is almost always somebody in adolescent medicine who's had a lot of experience with eating disorders.
Mm-hmm. Of course. Makes sense. So then,
it blows up in their face.
What would you say, or how would you handle, you know, we live in such a diet-centric society, weight stigma is a huge thing. So then how do you go about determining, in air quotes, the proper weight or a healthy weight for an individual without getting sucked into the BMI and all that stuff?
I don't talk about weight much at all with my patients. As I say to them, it's a measure of gravitational force.
Yep, I remember.
And if the answer, and if the answer was weight, I think everybody should sign up and decide to be astronauts for SpaceX, because you can go up in space and weigh nothing, and you're eating something soft. Just like a trip or two around the planet, you weigh nothing, you're back to your old self. Mm-hmm. Of course, it has nothing to do with weight, really. Becomes a focal point, but it's like saying the Civil War was about the Battle at Gettysburg, that strip of land there. No, it wasn't. It was about something completely different. Mm-hmm. And so there is a war that goes on inside of somebody, and it's more important to understand what it's about. When I assess someone with an eating disorder, I certainly look at all the medical ramifications, because those are often very objective. They're not subjective. They're not based on opinion, like, I think you look good or something like that. Your heart rate is really low. Your blood pressure is low. Your temperature is low. Your hands are blue. You're losing your hair. You have lost muscle mass. If you're having trouble, for example, somebody comes in who's an athlete, and they say, no, I'm just really athletic. And I said, well, then why do you get dizzy standing up? Mm-hmm. If just standing up, your heart's having a hard time getting blood to your brain, how explain why that means you're so healthy? And using that as a way not only to address a very important part of eating disorders, but to start breaking through some of the idea that this is just about appearance, and that, and starting to have the person start to use their right brain and not just, I mean, their left brain and not just the right brain, where they start using their intellect, which is almost always very keen, people with eating disorders, as a counter and saying, well, I know how you feel, but how do you think? And if you look at this, you know something's wrong. Your hands are blue. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's 50 outside and you would think you're in Minnesota in the snowstorm. And there's something else going on. And then after I explain it and I show them or their family, their parents and all that, whoever involved, their loved ones who need to be involved, I said, here's your EKG, here's your lab work. There is something going on here that's really serious. that does tend to give the treatment team a foothold to really establish a relationship, which I think is really important, not just appointments, but a relationship. And say that, look, there's a lot going on. You certainly have the medical. We have to address that. And in the meantime, talk about how did this come about? There's some important stuff that's happened. Mm-hmm. And to bring this about, we need to figure it out. How do we keep it from getting worse and get it to where it's back to the way it was?
Definitely. Would you say in, you know, your professional opinion, because I feel like obviously we know that eating disorders do not discriminate. And I know before I admitted to having one and experienced my eating disorder, I always thought I didn't have one because I didn't quote unquote look like I had one. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like a lot of individuals fly under the radar because of that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. And I have patients or other people, clinicians, say, well, she couldn't have an eating disorder. She doesn't, and she's not fat or she's not really thin. And some of the most dangerously ill medically have been people of normal weight, normal appearance, or even what would be considered generally in society a very positive appearance, whatever that is. Mm-hmm. And so clinicians can have their own bias as well as can the public. And they can miss it for the same reasons. I have seen so many athletes who are told that they're fine because they haven't had a period in 7 years, because that's what happens to good athletes. Or, yeah, you lost all your breast tissue, your estrogen's low, but that's what we see in athletes. Or a heart rate of 30, had one patient with a heart rate of 32, and the cardiologist said, well, that's an athletic heart. I said, no, it's not. He said, I said, she has a small heart. And he said, well, small hearts are good. And I said, not if you're an athlete. And he refused to even see her. I said, well, send her to the ER if you think she needs it. And I'll see what the ER doctor says. I said, no, I know what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Anyway, the cardiologist I usually use, who had been on call, I called on Monday morning. She admitted to cardiac care unit, where she stayed for 3 weeks because her heart rate got in the low 20s at night. They kept the crash cart outside of her room. So that cardiologist got an idea that maybe they need to reconsider some things.
Yeah.
Lots of misinformation out there, lots of bias. And wouldn't it be nice if we didn't have to look at those kinds of patients?
Yeah. I hate that. I hate that there's this, you know, huge misconception about eating disorders, and that people only think that, oh, well, if they're very, very underweight, or, you know, they live in a much larger body, then there's an issue or there must be something going on. When in reality, you know, as we know, as I said before, eating disorders don't discriminate. They don't have a look. They don't, you know, they affect all genders, all ages, all sizes. And so I just think that's such an important message to take home for sure.
Absolutely. People need to open their mind up, clear out some of the prejudice or bias that might be there unintended. Mm-hmm. And most people don't want to be doing that, but don't realize it.
Yeah.
And now that I will tell you what I see people in people who develop eating disorders, in my experience, seems almost universal. And I tell this to patients when they come in. I say, I'm going to tell you certain characteristics that I find in people with eating disorders. You remember this?
Yes, I remember this. Oh, man.
And I'll say, all right, number one, they're all hardworking. I've never had a patient deny that, not one. I said, because who else would do this? If you were lazy or whatever, you'd say, to heck with this. Give me the burger and the fries. Throw in the milkshake, too. I mean, you wouldn't expose yourself to this extremely difficult way of living for a while. And not because it's conscious, but once you're in it, it's awful. So then the other thing I say next is they're extremely empathic. You can walk into an auditorium and seventh row, third seat from the left, you would say, there's somebody not having a good day. Yeah. And again, I may have had only a handful of people say, no, that's not me. But then usually a parent will say, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
And then I say they're intuitive. You can be sitting there in class and the professor walks in and you turn to the person next to you, wow, he's in a bad mood today. The other one goes, why? And you say, did you see the way he put the book on the table? You just read things earlier.
Yeah.
And then I say that people with eating disorders are gifted and talented in at least one of the following, but also usually more than one: academics, athletics, creative expression. I say, which one of these don't apply? And the majority of time, overwhelming majority of time, is they all do. They usually say it very humbly. Well, yeah, I guess so. Said, well, it's like God gave you this, 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 and this, and this, and this. Said, but there's something you got to work on. And that's going to make everything else feel like the wheels came off. And you're suddenly de-skilled at managing it. And it's really frustrating because people like you would normally just buckle up, hit the road as hard as you can and take care of it. But this one defies that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, looking back on my experience, I always remember, and I remember telling you numerous times, like, I don't understand. I do really well in school. I'm a hard worker. You know, I can do all these things, but I just can't lose weight. Like, diets don't work. Like, that's the one thing that I fail at consistently. Like, why isn't it working? And obviously, it's because diets don't work, but it took me a heck of a long time to realize that. So, yeah. That,
you did a great job, by the way, in doing that.
Thank you. I appreciate
it. I remember it clearly.
Yeah. No, I mean, it was definitely a very, very hard experience and the toughest thing I've ever had to do in my life, but I would do it 1,000 times over because it saved me in so many different ways.
Yeah. You had a lot of things pulling you to not do that too, if you recall.
Oh, yes.
And
so many. It would
have been real easy to not have done what you, along with the support of your family, you took the hard road.
Yeah.
It turned out to be the right road.
100%. Speaking of family, how do you handle whenever you have a family of a patient that isn't exactly on the same page, you know, or is very diet centric and is enabling the behavior?
Can we have a simpler question, please?
Yeah, it's a tough one.
I find that really a struggle. It's I try to orient myself, okay, what are the big issues going on here? How much is the individual's own something happened? Or is it, I generally see that eating disorders don't occur in a vacuum. Mm-hmm. And if there is support from the family to do what it takes to get well, that they will humble themselves to a degree, not give up all their input or anything like that, but to agree to say, okay, let's re-examine some of the stuff that we've been doing. Those families and their children, whatever the age, be them even adult children, do better, much faster. The ones where there is this entrenched attitude about certain things about food, all the food rules and what's good food, bad food, and all that, I like to get them involved, if at all possible, with a good family therapist who's good at handling these kinds of things where my view, the parent, one or both parents are involved essentially in something that means more than just about food. And they have to work on their own security, their insecurities, their perspectives, and deal with some uncomfortable feelings, whatever they're about. And that's really hard because they've been living with whatever that is, probably for a lot longer time. Also, I think most parents, if you could really get them in an honest moment, most of them blame themselves, even though they may say they don't. And I think one of the ways to avoid that is to focus on something else being the cause or something. I'm not saying the parent necessarily caused the eating disorder, but may have a role in it.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And that's hard to admit, because here you have this child, whatever age, is suffering and with this mysterious illness, and you feel helpless or guilty at causing it.
Yeah, 100%.
Does that answer your question?
Oh, yeah, no, it definitely answers my question. And I have a couple more questions for you that I kind of want to shift in topic. So these things are more on the food side, I guess, medically. So I'm very curious about your opinion on these things. How do you approach, and what is your opinion on dealing with food intolerances with eating disorders?
Well, first of all, I want to find out what the intolerance actually is.
Okay.
What's it based on? Is it actual physical intolerance because you have, let's say you have the celiac disease, mm-hmm. where you cannot have gluten? Because it really does cause a serious complication. Or is it a perceived thing? And that when I eat this, I feel worse. Well, that can be so many different things. And if people come in and say they have allergies, I want to make sure it's really what they say, because there's some people who do these blood tests for allergies, which, I'm sorry, have a very high false positive rate. And so you can go in and say, well, you got allergy to this, and all these things. And here we have to restrict your diet to this. And boy, you want to set off an eating disorder. That is, go ahead, put them in a starvation diet.
Yeah.
Take away the stuff that they can eat, and that's actually probably very good for them because of some supposed allergy that's not there. Happens commonly, I think, when you see that. So, but sometimes these intolerances may be because they think that kind of food is bad.
Yeah.
You know, where do you hear that? I pose a question to people who come in, well, fat's bad or whatever. I don't know if I did this with you. I don't think I did. But I will say, okay, let's say you're in somewhere on the planet where there's starvation. Mm-hmm. It's serious. And you're driving along the road and you see somebody starving on the side and you want to help them. You got two choices of food. One is a Big Mac, double meat, double cheese, bacon burger, fries, and a milkshake. And the other one is a Greek salad, feta cheese, some julienne vegetables, and some light Caesar dressing. Which one would give them more of what they need?
Definitely the burger.
Right.
Yeah.
So maybe we have to consider when a food is good or bad. Maybe what we ought to do is think, rethink that. And maybe it's not really bad food. It's a question more of how much of what.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with Greek salads, and there's nothing wrong with burgers. Now, if all you have is Greek salad, something's going to be a problem. All you have is hamburgers with meat and cheese and all that. Well, there's going to be a problem.
Yeah.
So it's really, what is it this person needs sets him or her separately from anybody else, even within the family.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I asked the question because I know for me, when I worked with you, one of the big things that I was told was, oh, you're gluten intolerant. And I took a blood test for it. And my pediatrician, it was like right when I was 18. So I had just finished almost with him. And he had said, oh yeah, you're having all these issues with your period and your cramping and your bloating because you're intolerant of gluten. Cut out gluten and you'll be fine. And I did that. I cut out gluten for many years and I was quote unquote fine. Emotionally, I was a wreck, and psychologically, I was a mess. But then I remember when I went to go see you, you were like, no, I think you just should start eating gluten. And so did my dietitian at the time. And so I did, and it was a little bit tough at the beginning because, you know, reintroducing something is mm-hmm. hard on the body, but I'm fine. I mean, I eat gluten every day now and I'm totally fine. So yeah, that was just a curiosity I had because I know there's still people though that tell me, you know, sometimes that reach out and they're like, yeah, but like, it still really, really bothers my stomach. I'm not allergic, but it still bothers my stomach.
Well, people who are malnourished, almost any food can bother their stomach. Mm-hmm. If you have trouble because you have low calorie low protein stores, you may have trouble making enzymes to digest food. And so things like lactose, they'll come in, say, well, I'm lactose tolerant. I can't have any dairy. And I'll say, why not? And they say, well, I'm lactose intolerant. That's why nobody's died of lactose intolerance. Now, the people around them may be thinking they're dying from your lactose intolerance, but actually nobody dies. And it's not that serious. And malnutrition is serious.
Yeah.
I also tell them that eating some food here is going to make you feel bad, but in the long run, it will help you. Not eating this food will feel okay, but it will harm you in the long run.
That's very true.
That's a choice you have to make.
Mm-hmm. 100%. Definitely. Another curiosity I had, and I actually posed this question with my audience on my social media account, because I have a lot of strong views about it, but macros. So a lot of people think that macro counting and engaging in that is not a diet, and that it's something that they do and it's healthfully, and you know, they still love themselves and all these things. And I'm not going to judge anybody. I totally respect their opinion, but I will respectfully disagree. I feel like if there's this need to hyper focus on what you're eating or counting and tracking what you're eating, I'm wondering what the reasoning behind it is. And so I'm curious as to what your thoughts are.
I think you're correct to say, okay, what's the reason why you're doing it? Tell me, how did you happen onto this? Mm-hmm. How did you find this? Were you searching for something? Why was that?
Yeah.
And why this? It's always curious to ask people, why is it this, what you decided that, no, I can't have much carbohydrate. No, I can't have much protein. No, I can't have much fat. Oh, no, I can't have this. I've got to have that. It's got to be green and yellow, not red and, I don't know, red and white. So it's curious how they came to that. What were the influences? Where did that come from? I'm not denying that they might feel better on something, but that doesn't mean it's because of what was in the food necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But if there's something major, really physiologically major going on with some food you eat, you will find out.
Yeah.
And we will probably be able to see it in the results of what happens either in your blood work or how your body functions. Something like that's going to show up.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I would tell people, anytime you start cutting food out, you really need to ponder the wisdom of that.
Yeah.
Because then what I, as you know, you can start constricting it a little more, shave it down a little more, a little more. People come in and say, what other foods can I cut out instead of what foods can I add?
Mm-hmm.
Sort of like, wait a minute, that food is good for you. You need to have food.
Yeah, exactly. Well, and I also think there's this kind of tied into the macro counting, but it's not a diet, is that some people believe like, oh, I can still pursue weight loss and be happy and love myself and like not get into that dangerous territory. It's hard for me to see it in an unbiased opinion because I did struggle with an eating disorder. But what are your thoughts on that? Like, do you feel like someone can engage in some sort of weight loss program or diet and like still be happy with themselves and be functioning properly and not develop any sort of disordered eating?
I suppose it happens.
You don't seem convinced.
Well, everything's a bell-shaped curve. There's some people who can do that, and it doesn't do much, but it's risky at best, and especially if you're doing it in children, young adults, because you have a developing mind and brain and body.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be really careful, and because you may set off something that's much worse. Don't forget, people, that eating disorders have the highest mortality rate of any psychiatric illness except for opiate addiction.
Yes.
And so it can do that.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we can go into statistics and stuff, but it's really a dangerous illness.
Mm-hmm.
I think there, well, there, there's been, I think, three different times that there's been an analysis of what happens to people who are on a calorie restricting diet, some big study. I need to get the data so I can just roll it off my tongue. And every time what they find is 95% of people who go on a calorie restricting diet wind up gaining weight by 6 months to 2 years.
Oh yeah, I believe it.
Which means what else in medicine would we recommend, especially so casually, and of course, some intervention in which 95% of the people get worse and only 5% get better. I mean, there's not, and I don't care if it was a cancer drug. Nope, never reached the stage of doing human trials or anything. I mean, they just, that's not the kind of stuff they would ever approve. Yeah. But, oh, we say it so commonly. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, you need to, it just rolls off the tongue so easily. Okay, now next patient, come in. Done. I'm taking care of that.
Yeah.
And it's a false hope for somebody. So people say, well, what do I do about losing weight? I said, well, first of all, do we have time for me to go through this?
Oh my gosh, of course. Okay. I'm on no time constraint.
Oh, okay, good. So first of all, I say to them, your brain protects you from even yourself. Starvation is considered a threat to the body. So your brain is going to try to protect you from that. It will try to hear my dog. My dog just is snoring over there. I wanted you to know that is my dog, not me. So the brain protects you from even yourself. And if you start to go into restriction mode, you're going to compensate for that by trying to protect your stores of energy. It will be that you'll lower your metabolic rate, your heart rate, things like that. You'll feel less like being active and so on and so on. So you must do it in a way that the brain does not sense an emergency. Now look, if there's too much fat, it's like saying to somebody, well, gosh, man, you just inherited, you know, $10 million. Yeah, I don't know what to do. I better get rid of all this money. No. But if you had $10 and that's all you had, you would really feel desperate. And so the brain's not really that different. So the brain's saying, if you go through a restrictive phase, say, well, evidently didn't learn last time. You're probably going to do this again. Let me add more on to be prepared for the winter, so to speak. When you go into a diet again, I want to have enough stored energy to survive whatever it is you're going to do.
Yeah.
And so the best thing is to just have a very gradual way of managing this. First of all, take care of all the other stuff that goes on, like, you know, fear of foods or these foods or fat, you know, fear of fat or, you know, whatever. Deal with the things that are really at play. And then let your body physiologically adapt without putting it in an emergency mode. Now, exercise is something you can include when the exercise is not going to be triggering for worsening an eating disorder, somebody's situation, and then tailoring that to the person that's appropriate for them, whatever they feel. Generally, I think the more skills-based activity it is, the less it's going to be become something that's more turning into an eating disorder behavior.
Yeah.
And add that, and gradually over time. But there's no quick answer. You go into an emergency diet or you start restricting, your body's going to fight you. It's going to fight.
Yeah, definitely.
And it usually wins.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Yeah. So have you ever had any patient come in and I recently had a conversation with someone and they were concerned because their child was, you know, maybe reaching for constantly unhealthy, quote unquote, unhealthy foods, like, you know, never really, really wanting like the fruits or the veggies. And they just didn't really have a very balanced approach way of eating. So how do you do that with children? Like, what approach do you take with that? Because you don't want to be like, okay, obviously go on a diet. That's not the case. You want to teach them and be more intuitive with their options. So if you have a fearful parent that comes in and is like, I'm really fearful for my child, all they're doing is eating quote unquote unhealthy foods. How do you navigate that?
I identify with the parent that this is a very difficult issue, mm-hmm. because you realize early on that there's some things that this little kid, I thought I was the boss. This kid can act like this and I can feel helpless to decide what to do. It can be really tough. Mm-hmm. I emphasize that if you say, yeah, it's still okay for you to have Oreos or whatever it else you want, you need to balance it with other stuff. I don't care what it is. You try to say, all right, you want ice cream, fine, have ice cream, whatever the food or foods are, that's fine. But we're also going to have this. And the more you can emphasize that, mm-hmm. without making food bad, mm-hmm. and without making them feel shame for their tastes. Don't forget, we have people out there who, for whatever reason, develop these sensitivities and these preferences, and that some textures just do not go well, or they develop something else, like the ARFID patients. I hate that title for a eating disorder. But who are avoidant and restrictive because they're afraid the food's going to do something to them, mm-hmm. or because the taste or the texture just is something that they have a real strong aversion to. Mm-hmm. And now some of that, I think most of that is learned, but not all of it. I think some of it is due to other stuff.
Yeah.
For example, I had a patient once who was in the hospital and had no family around. And I asked some of my patients who were farther along if they would mind going to visit her and kind of give her a little group support. And several of them did. And one of them said, I would love to, but I can't. I said, why not? She said, I can't. I said, okay, that's fine. But you could tell she wanted to process this. I said, what? She said, I can't go into a hospital. Mm. I said, I want to, but I can't. I said, well, what is it about the hospital? She said, I don't know. Just like that. I don't know. As soon as I asked the question, I said, how do you not know if you hadn't thought about it? It sounds like maybe there's something there. You have any idea? No, I don't, but I can't. I said, well, what is it about a hospital that bothers you? I can't even walk into it. I said, why not? She said, it's the smell, the lights, the sounds. I said, have you ever been in a hospital? She said, no, never. I said, not even, were you born in a hospital? She said, oh, yeah, well, I was born in a hospital. And then she said, oh, and I was a preemie for 6 weeks.
Oh.
What happened? How do they feed you when you're a preemie? Well, they put tubes in. There's all the sounds, there's the smells, there's the body sensations you get. That's trauma.
100%.
And you're cold? Are you really hot or whatever? You get cold really quickly. You can't have good temperature regulation. And that part of the brain, the amygdala, remembers that. And that's why you react to it when you go in the hospital. And she goes, wow, that's right. That's it. That got to be it. Yeah. So there are these things that happen to people about food, but there's usually something that can be done for it.
Yeah.
And so, but it may not be simply just, you know, got to eat your vegetables. You do have to, as a parent, try to get them to do it.
Yeah.
And see what you can do. Adolescence turns out to be an interesting time because with all the social pressure, that's when a lot of times this comes to a head. But also a lot of times the social pressure helps the person break through the barrier to where they can then try eating differently.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, my my little sister, she's my little half sister. She's 8 years old, and my dad is trying to kind of break her from the all I want is grilled cheese, pasta, and white rice. And so, you know, he has a hard time with it, because he's like, okay, like, you got to eat more than that. Like, let's go. We're going to have this salmon for dinner. And I think he's kind of just introduced the approach of like, yes, you can have those things, but tonight this is what the dinner is and you're going to eat this, or I'm sorry, but there's not much of another option. And I think she's finally kind of warming up to it, but it was tough at the beginning because all she wanted was like pizza, spaghetti, and like fried foods. And that's
sure. Sure.
So.
I see that frequently. Yeah. And some of the dietitians are really good at this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Really good. I've seen some really good work by the dietitians of being really sensitive to that, but also, and it's almost always because the person feels understood and accepted, and that makes them less fearful, and they're willing to maybe make a little try.
Yeah.
And so... That's really helpful to have good clinicians around you who can help with this.
Yeah, 100%. I love learning about like you and your profession and just eating disorders in general. I think my knowledge has grown so much from having experienced it myself. And now I'm wanting to pursue the, you know, certification in eating disorders. So I'm really excited about that. So I want to hear from you, like, what's your favorite part about your job?
I love what I do.
Yes.
For the audience, there are very few doctors in private practice who focus on eating disorders. And as far as I know, I might have been the first. Certainly the first to see just eating disorders, male and female of all ages. And... but people who come and spend time with me, doctors or residents or medical students or pre-med, they're like, wow, this is amazing. This is great. This is so incredible. Your patients are wonderful. So yeah, remember that you get to work with people like I get to work with. I love the challenges. I love the connections. I tell myself each time I meet a new patient, this is probably, if it works out, is going to be a long-term relationship.
Yeah.
And that you never know where it's going to go, but it's so rewarding. I've watched people go from near the very bottom of their life and stuff to where they have achieved such wonderful things. And they want to include me in celebrating some of that.
I wonder who that could be. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
The rewards. I've had one asked me to perform the marriage ceremony.
Oh my gosh. That's incredible. That's beautiful.
Had another asked me to her wedding in North Carolina and had me at the rehearsal dinner and all of that. Wanted me there. And it's stuff like that. And it's the little things.
Yeah.
The appreciation, the smile on the face, and you see life coming back and somebody's, oh boy, that's, to me, that's what medicine, when I want to be a doctor, that's what I think about wanting to be a doctor is.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for having this conversation with me and giving your opinions and your feedback. I think this is going to be a really cool episode for people to listen to, and I think they're going to learn a lot from it. So I really, really appreciate you being on the podcast.
You bet. And if you ever want to do something, I'd love to talk about body image and
yes,
think about all that sometime.
Definitely. We'll have to get you on it again so we can talk about
it. Sounds good. Well, I wish you a lot of luck with this. You're going to have some really good people.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.